Hello, Dr. Ian, are you okay?
Hi, I'm good. Thanks. How are you?
I'm very well, thank you.
Good.
Thank you for coming on to speak to myself and the community. It's a pleasure to have you on board. If people don't know the amazing work that you do, are you able to just give a brief explanation of everything you do regarding anxiety?
Yeah, so I'm a counseling psychologist by background, so I'm trained in a range of different approaches, and I really believe in fitting the therapeutic approach to the person rather than the other way around. So I offer therapy, I offer training. I've currently written a book which is coming out next week, which is about
Oh,
relationships and
congratulations.
anxiety. Thank you. So it's about getting the right information out there, but also some therapeutic support when people need it. And I do actually work with a lot of people who've been through anxiety and also trauma.
Right. You said your book. What's the book?
So it's
What's it
here.
about?
So it's called The Magic in Me.
Oh,
So
fantastic.
it's a 30-day self-empowerment book. And I think it's important to give people tools and strategies that they can integrate into their everyday life. I think there's lots of awareness, but what do we actually do if we're feeling overwhelmed? How do we look at the link between our feelings, our thoughts, and our behaviors? And so it's a bit like having a psychologist in your pocket. There's 30 days worth of activities, but also some journaling around that just to really increase the reflection and the connection with yourself, because I'm a really firm believer that the relationship with ourselves is really important, and that then does shape our experiences, whether that's our other relationships or our perspective on the world as well.
What do you find that I completely agree with you, what you said there, the relationship with yourself. So when you have anxious people coming to you, is there a certain pattern that you see the relationship that they have with themselves?
Yeah, so I feel like anxiety really does mess with our emotions and it messes with our mind. So often I can bet money that there's negative thoughts associated with feeling anxious. But also for some people, it really amps up the self-criticism, the comparison to other people, this sense of not feeling good enough. And I hear this all the time. Underlying fear is that I'm not good enough or I'm going to fail in some way. And that's really hard, you know, the thoughts are like background music in our head that's constantly going, and sometimes we pay attention to it and sometimes we don't. But I also want to challenge the myth that people who are anxious are a heap on the floor. You know, sometimes people will feel irritable or on edge, or they're really highly functioning, or they're perfectionists, or they overplan, and sometimes they don't see that as anxiety either. So that can be a bit of a realization for people as well, in terms of it being quite a normal response to things, but also helping to understand why they might do certain things to help them feel better.
I remember speaking to, I think he was a manager at the time, and he was so outgoing, the center of attention in a group of people. And I remember having a candid conversation to him when I was opening up about panic attacks that I was dealing with at the time. And he told me that the way that he presented himself to everyone, this outgoing person, was a way of him distracting himself from his own thoughts and physical sensations. So I think, like you said, it's really important to know that it's not a one size fits all. And like you say, it's not about being in a ball on the floor. Yes, I imagine some people can feel like that. But for some people, they're out and about in society. You wouldn't even know they were dealing with anxiety. I remember my worst panic attack I had. I was in the middle of my workplace in the office, and I had to leave. Well, my body told me I had to leave. And I remember coming back, and I spoke to my friend next to me, and he thought I looked as calm as a cucumber. He thought I'd just gone to make a cup of tea. However, inside, I was literally thought that it was a medical emergency. So it's really important to open up and speak to people around you, because you don't know what they're going through, do you?
100%. And sometimes it's just that relief to kind of name something
Mm.
and for it to be normalized. And what you'll probably find is other people will say, oh, yeah, that kind of happens to me too.
Yeah.
And, you know, just a knock-on effect of that in terms of things like sleep or just feeling on edge all the time is really exhausting as well. So you might feel tired, you might feel overwhelmed, you might feel angry, you might feel irritable. So I think by normalizing the conversation, it allows space for different emotions to come in. So rather than like avoiding the emotions and the thoughts, you learn to lean into them a little bit, which initially feels a bit counterintuitive, but
Yeah.
that's the way you start to feel more in control without having to put lots of things into place to feel in control.
What do you say to people who say, well, it's just too hard to lean into panic attacks off or intrusive thoughts, for example?
I think it's a step-by-step process. So, I think first of all, be compassionate and kind because it is, it's not a logical process. It's that fight or flight instinctual response. So what I often say to people is, it's not that you're not a logical person or you can't do it. Even Einstein, if he was in that fight or flight mode, would struggle. So first of all, just start by regulating your emotions. So you want to get in tune with your body and just try and notice like what happens when I feel anxious. What's the first signs? What goes on in my body? And then even if you just take a breath or start to incorporate some strategies here and there, you can then use that as the foundation to sort of build on. And it is a process. It's like a reset of the body and the brain, but it's definitely possible. But I'm also really, I do understand that when people are first dealing with anxiety, or if they've been dealing with anxiety for a long time, the possibility of not having anxiety in their life just feels a bit out of reach initially.
That's really interesting what you said, because as I learned and developed these coping skills to help reduce anxiety in the moment, you do, and it is what it is education, isn't it? Because I did realize that, well, when I'm feeling anxious or when my heart's palpitating, I have these irrational, anxious thoughts that are racing through my mind. And by being present and being mindful within the moment, I could really recognize the cycle of anxiety. And I think when you do that, it really takes away some of the fear of the unknown, because you start to learn about the process and learn that even though it feels dangerous, it isn't dangerous. So feeling dangerous and actually being dangerous are two completely separate things. And like you said, in that fight or flight moment, that is the body's doing its job, isn't it? The body is trying to protect you from a danger, but we know in anxiety disorder the danger's not there. But the reason it feels so real is because the body's doing exactly what it should be doing if there was, say, a saber-tooth tiger in front of us.
Yeah, it's a bit like a faulty smoke alarm that's going off when the toast is burning. So you just want to reset that over time. And sometimes what I say to people is, even if you put a little bit of structure at the beginning and the end of your day, so I say tag on a breathing technique, for example, to when you're brushing your teeth in the morning. So it doesn't have to be long, it can be 30 seconds. Start there. And then what you'll start to do is regulate your emotions a little bit more or understand when you're feeling a little bit more on edge. And it will take a bit of time. So it's like a skill that you can develop. And even if you get anxious, I think even knowing that that will pass, and then you can start to think about strategies for the next time or the support that you can put into place for yourself.
What do you say to people who say, well, 6 months ago, I didn't have to do all these coping techniques. I didn't have to wake up in the morning and do these breathing techniques. Why do I have to do it now? Why me? What would you say to someone if they said that?
Well, I can understand that it doesn't feel fair, but what I would also say is what you're doing is you're being proactive rather than reactive. And the more proactive you are, you can actually then start to create new pathways in your brain, which will then switch you for over time from being more reactive to more proactive and reflective. And that way you're less likely to go into fight or flight. Or what you'll notice over time is if your highs and lows are a bit like this, they start to regulate a little bit more, or you get more confident in coming back to your equilibrium. So you start to feel in control of your body a little bit more, and then your mind a little bit more, and that will change your behaviors. It's a bit like if you were to make a physical change. Some people might say, well, why do I need to go to the gym? And I think it is a personal choice, but actually, if you're working towards a goal, then there will be kind of action steps that need to happen as well.
And I thought that was really good what you said about when you're doing these coping techniques, to really make it part of your daily routine, in moments when you're not anxious, because I know from experience in the community, and probably experience myself when I was dealing with panic attacks, if you're in the middle of a panic attack and you haven't practiced these breathing techniques, for some people it can create more anxiety because they feel like it's not working in the moment. So the anxiety is not going away. So I think that's why it's really important to put these coping techniques in your daily routine when you're not anxious, so you can learn it, master a new skill, and then be able to use it proactively when you're feeling anxiety.
Yeah, because if you're in the midst of feeling overwhelmed or anxious, if you think about the way anxiety works, it hijacks your logic. So that means your problem solving is gone, your ability to sometimes verbalize what's going on is gone. Being in the moment feels like it's gone because you're in survival rather than thriving. But if it's something that feels familiar, what you can do is almost over time your logic will come back on and go, hang on a minute, what's going on here? Okay, the last time this happened, maybe this breathing technique helped me. So I could run away or I could avoid, but I could also try this. And then you start to solidify that because it's something which is familiar to you.
I often get people say the heart palpitations I can deal with, the sweating I can deal with, feeling on edge I can deal with, but derealization, depersonalization, where it feels like I'm on a different consciousness, almost like I've taken drugs or something, that I can't deal with, that freaks me out.
Yeah.
What would you say to those people?
So what I would say is if you can try and catch the anxiety symptoms as they rise, that's great. Over time you might. But if you are in that state, then bring yourself back to this current moment wherever you can. So this is a little bit of mindfulness. This is a little bit around being present. So you might go back into your body or back into your mind. So one quick technique might be color spotting, where you're looking around the space that you're in. You pick a color and you notice everything that has that color in it. And what you'll start to notice is initially the big things, and then you'll hone in on little details, which will then bring you back to the here and now. You could also try something like muscle relaxation where you breathe in and tense so you can go into your body, breathe out and relax, or something like a perfume or a cologne or an essential oil just to shock your senses a little bit back into the here and now. So you could think about really simple ways that you might be able to do some mindfulness on the go, because often there's a fear around it being quite exposing or people are going to notice, but I could be color spotting now and you wouldn't even know that I'm doing it.
Yeah, no, definitely. And I can understand why people, especially derealization, because I have experienced that with panic attacks, and it feels crazy. It feels like, yeah, you're on a different plane, different consciousness, almost like an out of body experience. And I could imagine when, so I agree with you about grounding techniques. I think they're wonderful. But I could imagine while trying to do that, that there'd be this inner critic saying to you, like, oh, I'm freaking out. I'm still feeling this oddness. Would your advice be just carry on through it?
Yeah, if you can, and then you can also think about maybe alternative statements if you want. Another technique you can use is tapping. So this is an EMDR-based tapping. I know there's EFT and other techniques, but with tapping, if you think about the stress response, what happens is, all that cortisol is released into the body and we kind of go into the panic. This can work with that nervous system. So what you would do is either tap on your legs like this. If you're sitting down, you tap on your thighs, or you would do sort of butterfly tapping and tap one side and then the other. And you can then start to incorporate sort of positive statements into it. And it might just even be a statement or a grounding statement like, I'm safe. But even if you are not using tapping and you're using something like color spotting, if that critic is there, you can just start to recognize why you're safe. So start to try and look for some of the green flags or start to bring some sensation into your body again.
That's wonderful. And just for the people who may not know the difference between the two forms of tapping, so EFT and did you say EMDR?
EMDR, yeah.
Yeah. What's the difference between them two?
Sure. So I'm not an expert in emotional freedom technique, but from what I know, you tap on different meridian points, which then helps in the body, and you use statements, and that can also help to calm your nervous system. EMDR is eye movement desensitization and reprocessing. So EMDR is a specific technique that's used with trauma, flashbacks, nightmares, dreams. So it's mainly used in trauma work, and that's just slightly different because that is gets you out of fight or flight essentially. So if you're feeling overwhelmed, it's a different way to tap. But either will work. I think it's good to play around with a few techniques, and that's why doing one at the beginning of the day and one at the end of the day, you can just test out what feels right for you.
Even the, well, you say even the action of tapping it is a form of mindfulness, isn't it? Because you're present in the moment, tapping on the spot.
Yeah.
So I could see how that was useful. Pretty sure that when I had some counselling, I was introduced to tapping with a counsellor, and I remember speaking to my doctor, and I was like, "What is the science behind this? Is it placebo? It is." Do you mean, is there any science behind this? And they said, do you know what, Dean? We don't care. If it's reducing the people's anxiety, then we are happy.
There is
We don't
some
need,
science behind it.
there is science.
There is science behind it. So if you think about even the action of walking or running, it's like one side and then the other. So what happens if you think about your brain, you've got your instinct and you've got your logic. When we go into that fight or flight, the logic gets hijacked. So we're working on that instinct. So what something like tapping does is it's a process called bilateral stimulation. Really, essentially what it does is it gets both parts of the brain talking to each other again, so it reconnects. So that's the science behind it, and that's why it takes you out of fight or flight, because the logic has a chance to sort of come on. How that works, I'm not 100% sure, but that's what I know about it.
That's interesting. So that's like where you have the first fear and then the second fear response. So it brings you back to the present to recognize that the first fear was a false alarm, yeah. Wonderful. I've got some questions from the community. I can see they have been rushing away, so we'll try and get through as many as we can. I'll just let you answer them. So, how many physical symptoms can be anxiety related?
Well, that does vary from person to person. Some people will say they have no physical responses, but for others, it can be your heart racing, it can be sweating, it can be needing to go to the toilet more often, maybe becoming a bit more overwhelmed and tearful, that edgy feeling in your body, or a bit of a disconnect, feeling sick. So it's really, really individual for people. So some people might notice their thoughts more. So what I say to people is, where do you feel it in your body? And that might then help you to figure out where you would pay attention to. So for some people, they'd be like, it's here. For others, they say, oh yeah, it is my tummy. It's like a knot in my stomach. So you just want to start to pay attention if you can, and you'll be able to identify your own like triggers or your own symptoms.
I remember when I was going through my panic disorder, anxiety would be sneaky. You get used to certain symptoms, and then suddenly you'd wake up and your arm would be switching, which had never happened again. And it just shows that it is a full body response. And I often say you could put a symptom and the word anxiety after it, put it into Google, and it'd come up with that some people experience that. It's definitely just as much physical as it can be emotional. And that's really interesting what you said, that some people don't experience the physical side. So they're just focused on the irrational thinking, intrusive thoughts, is it?
Or they are disconnected from their bodies. They've never really been asked that question, or they've never really paid attention to it. So, for some people, it's, I suppose you can have an anxiety disorder without panic attacks as well. So, that's important to say as well. So, it might just be this feeling in your body. So, you will kind of know what that is for you. And different situations, different people might elicit a different response.
I know, like with general anxiety, they almost say it's like a simmering of anxiety throughout the day that doesn't boil over into the fight or flight response, but it is this uncomfortable. Often people speak about headaches and tension around the jaws and around the forehead and the neck and shoulders. I guess relaxation you're a big fan of as well, and stretching and things like that.
I think that works for some people. I like to give people a range of different options and then they can decide, but I hear that a lot as well, sort of tension in the neck and the shoulders, clenching of the jaw. So relaxation is really good for that if it's a very physical response in that way.
Fantastic. So the next question is because of a tragic loss, I'm constantly disassociated. So when I'm anxious, it's hard for me to ground myself. Would you have any tips for this person?
So I think the colour spotting could be a good place to start. But also sometimes you might want to shock your body to the here and now. So You might want to think about other senses, whether it's smell. So you could carry either an essential oil or even like a hand cream or a hand sanitizer, so it's not going to be so obvious. You could also think about taste, so like lemon, but then you could also think about temperature, so things like ice. So if you are doing muscle relaxation, you could put some ice into the palm of your hand, which isn't going to harm you, and then you could kind of squeeze that. So if you can start to integrate things, as I said, at the beginning and the end of the day, that would be useful. But then just think about how you can shock some of your other senses. So those would probably be my other suggestions there.
Wonderful. Next, loads of questions. Well, someone's put teen needs to learn more about anxiety and symptoms. I definitely agree with that. I think we should teach children psychoeducation at earliest as possible age and teach them basic CBT skills as well. I don't see any harm in that. So the next question, what causes our fight or flight system to keep reacting at the wrong time, and how do we stop it?
So, yeah, because our fight or flight system is quite primitive, it's not really suitable for the way that we live today. So we're like overstimulated, we're constantly bombarded with information. And with the fight or flight system, it can't tell the difference between sort of real threat or perceived threat. And that also includes emotional threat as well. So it can't tell the difference between a lion walking into a room or someone that you don't really get along with walking into the room. And that can tip us over the edge. So I think what causes it to keep reacting in that way is it can be the same feeling that comes up. It might be a situation where it then makes us feel on edge, and because we've dealt with it using the fight or flight system in the past, our body just naturally does that again. So you know, I think it's like a behavior that gets
Like learned behavior
reinforced over
almost.
time. Yeah, reinforced as a way to manage a certain situation. So what we really want to be doing is starting to change our perceptions either of ourselves or the situations around us. So, you know, it could be a loss of control that then triggers the fight or flight response because we feel unsafe, even if we're not unsafe physically.
What do you think? Do you think there's a link between like a buildup of stress and anxiety?
I think if you think about stress, we have less room to play with. So our tolerance is going to be decreased. So it probably takes less to switch us over to the other side, really. So if you think about stress, there's no actual definition for stress, interestingly enough, but it's just a response to kind of feeling on edge. But usually, if it is a stressor, once the stress is gone, that should bring down our levels of that kind of emotional overwhelm. But when we are in a constant state of stress, there's a much bigger link between that and anxiety, and I'd probably argue that they become a bit more similar.
Yeah, no, I definitely agree. It's like you often see a build up of these stresses that only the body and the mind can take so much, then it overspills into excessive anxiety and obviously it can be panic attacks and all the other horrible stuff that can come with it. The next question, is it possible to develop separation anxiety from my boyfriend because of my anxiety disorder?
I would say yes if you see him as a safe attachment. So you know, we sometimes feel that if we think about attachment, it's about feeling safe in a relationship. So you might kind of then develop some thinking that that's the only safe relationship, or you need that in order to function. And it's not uncommon when I sort of see couples that they find their partner is sort of their safe place or their safe person. And then it can be harder to separate from them, or the anxiety can increase when they're away from them. So yeah, I'd be just be thinking about what kind of thoughts happen when you're not with your partner. And you know, why do you feel unsafe maybe when you're not around them?
So would you say there's a fine balance? Because obviously, I think it's great to have a support network where you can open up, be honest with how you're feeling. With it with the right people, but then obviously, like you say, it can get to an area where separation anxiety can occur. How would you find that right balance?
So then you can get into kind of dependency. So I need you rather than kind of I want to be alongside you. So for example, if someone was coming to therapy and their partner had come along with them, I think it's great that their partner is supporting them, but eventually, or perhaps in the first session, I would encourage them to come into the space themselves. So okay. It's about tolerating a little bit of anxiety at a time. And then if they wanted to call that partner into that space, that's completely fine. But that would be a goal that I would work on with an individual. So I would probably suggest start by having maybe small pockets of time away from your partner, or engaging in activities by yourself for a little while, and then slowly start to build that up. So you might have some short-term goals and then some longer-term goals, which could be kind of going to social events by yourself. But you could start by, you know, maybe going to the doctors and having your partner wait in the car. And then slowly just start to stagger that a little bit. So we don't want to pull the safety net completely, but we just want to build windows where you can learn to cope a little bit longer on your own. And it will spike anxiety, but over time what will happen is you'll start to learn and know that you can manage that and you can tolerate that. So you kind of do need to step out of your comfort zone to create moments where you're tolerating anxiety a little bit more.
So when you mention like gradual exposure, which is basically what you was mentioning, obviously we have flooded exposure as well. From everything that you've seen, would you say that which is one of them better than the other, or is it an individual approach? Like, do you have a go-to one when you're dealing with people with anxiety?
I think it depends on the individual. Right. And I think particularly within therapy, it's really important for people to have a choice. Yes. So for me, I tend to work more with gradual exposure, because I feel like that person needs to build up trust with me to then be able to sort of do things. Mm-hmm. But I think it really depends on the individual, and probably a little bit of their histories as well. So maybe what are the triggers for anxiety? Where could they push? Is it generalized anxiety or is it in certain situations? Mm-hmm. But yeah, I'm always working from that position of not doing more harm than good. So I think it's still something that needs to be negotiated and discussed with the client, and then you would also look at the blocks and why there's a little bit of resistance. And I still might push and suggest things, but yeah, I personally work more with, because I work a lot with trauma, I work with gradual exposure, because I might be doing two or three techniques at the same time.
That's wonderful. It's wonderful that you use exposure therapy, because I did see a scientific study, which I'm not sure you may have seen it yourself, that quite a lot of therapists shy away from exposure therapy, even knowing the benefits of how good it can be for anxiety, because they feel like they don't want to put that person into discomfort, so they'll shy away from exposure therapy. So I always found that interesting. I wonder if you had a take on that.
Yeah, I think it's about having a safe enough relationship to do that. So you never enforce something onto someone, but I think it's something that can be discussed. I also use virtual reality in my therapy as well.
Oh, that's so fantastic.
You know, so I kind of use that as a way to maybe build on the exposure and then maybe do some stuff in the real world. So there'll always be suggestions, but we do have to tackle behavior as well as the feelings and the thoughts.
Yes.
But my perspective is that we also want to be tackling all of them, not just one element, because it's very easy to say to someone, why don't you just do this or this or this, and then you'll feel better. But actually, if you don't work with the thoughts and the feelings and the regulation, then they're not really going to have sort of long-term changes.
That's wonderful that you're using virtual reality. How are you using that in the therapy space?
So I've got a headset which I would use, and it would be for what's mainly around exposure and anxiety. Yes. So specific scenarios. So it could be public speaking, it could be social situations, but also things like mindfulness and relaxation. So I use it as a tool in therapy where I integrate it into some of the other things that we're doing. So, you know, that could be a place to start. And I think we've got adapt therapy with kind of need.
And have you found results regarding VR exposure?
Yeah, so I'm fairly new. It's been about a couple of months now. But yeah, I've worked with sort of younger people and then adults, and there's been a really good response. So you probably wouldn't use it with every client, but I think it's just another offer that you can suggest. Mm-hmm. And especially if you're working on a specific goal, it's a nice alternative to be able to help clients to manage anxiety in a particular situation in that moment with you.
Yeah, I think it's all about having, like you say, an array of tools. I think that's the wonderful thing about anxiety. Obviously, having anxiety disorders, not good, but it's good to know that there's many different treatment options available. And what works for one person may not work for another, but it's about curating the right path that works for one person. It's definitely a very individual approach, isn't it?
I
I
agree.
just want to try and get two more questions while I have you. There's so many of them. Let's see if I can get like a different one. Oh, this is a good one. One that I imagine you'd be familiar with. When someone screams at me, it triggers my past trauma. How do I deal with it?
Yeah, and that's really common because,
Yeah.
naturally you will feel in danger and your instinct will just take over. So I think after that, you just want to kind of go to a safe place. First of all, I don't see why someone should be screaming at you. So I'd be wondering kind of what's happening there.
Yes.
Most people in that situation, even without trauma, would maybe kind of question why they're being screamed at and is it appropriate? So I'll just put that in there. But
Yeah.
I think, yeah, it's natural that you're going to feel that way. And I would say just come back to the grounding. Get yourself to a safe place depending upon what's happening. Reach out for support if you need to as well. You might also want to think about maybe talking to a therapist about trauma, because what can happen is, although trauma therapy doesn't take away what's happened and it doesn't minimize it, what it can do is take the intensity out of your reactions. So there might be certain triggers that are even more activating for you, certain people, certain situations. And what trauma therapy can help with is to bring down the volume and some of that intensity. So you can zoom out and look at your past and understand and recognize and acknowledge what's happened, but also be more present in the moment. Because with anxiety and also with trauma, you never got 2 feet in the now. It's either 1 foot in the past, and 1 foot here, or 1 foot here and 1 foot in the future, and you're oscillating between the two. So I think just thinking about kind of if support for your trauma would be useful, but then also just coming back to the grounding and making sure you've got some safe networks that you can tap into. So you could think about your hand. So if you think about your hand and think about the key people in your life who are safe, you might engage with one of those, but you also might look at the palm of your hand, which is all your self-soothing strategies or your coping techniques. And then up your sleeve is maybe emergency contacts, depending upon what's going on. So if you just remember to look at your hand, it might be a reminder to engage in some sort of support to ground you.
That's a really good advice. Regarding trauma, what would you say to people who have obviously been through horrific trauma that they feel like that they can never get over or they can never process it? Would you say there's still hope for them sort of people?
Yeah, definitely. So I've worked with people with complex trauma, complex PTSD. You may never get over it, and the aim is not to get over it, but the aim is to be more present in the now. So you don't even have to go back into processing the memories if you don't want to. But I suppose what is useful is to learn some skills to keep you in the now so your trauma doesn't have a hold over you. So if it is impacting on your life in the now, then there are several things that you can do. One would be to focus on like something like CBT to give you some of the tools when you are triggered. Or you might say, do you know what? I need to go back and look at some of the patterns or look at some of the experiences to put them away in their box, which doesn't minimize them, but also doesn't keep them alive. Because trauma, flashbacks, a lot of that is like stuck memories that can be activated when we feel a certain way.
That's wonderful. So it's great to know there's still hope for people who have had really bad trauma. That's lovely to hear. The next, I'll do one more question while I have you. I guess we'll finish off with another trauma one. Does trauma change the way your brain works?
It can, yeah, it can, because what trauma can do is, if you're constantly in fight or flight, or you have experienced sort of trauma, it can put you into fight or flight more easily. So what your brain does more often than not is it looks for the red flags rather than the green flags. So over your time, your brain can be programmed to look for the danger. And that makes a lot of sense if you think about it, because that's what's kept you surviving, particularly if there's been multiple trauma. So in a way, like you were saying earlier, Your brain's just trying to keep you safe, it's trying to protect you. But there is a concept called neuroplasticity where you can sort of rewire the brain again. So if you start to engage in grounding, if you start to do some thought challenging, and that's something you do more consistently, and you work with your beliefs and you work with your thinking errors and your I am statements, and kind of process some of those memories, you can start to rewire the brain so it looks for more of the green flags and more of a balance, so you're not just attuned to danger.
So it's like opening up the mind to different ways of thinking. Because like you say, when we're dealing with anxiety or trauma, it's this inward thinking that's really zoned in on one type of thinking. And like you say, just opening the mind, you're not specifically looking for directly at positive things, but just realizing that there's positive and negative things. No, I think that's really interesting regarding that. Just regarding I just want to go back to your book before we leave. When is it available? How can people get their hands on it? Because I know we've had a lot of trauma questions as well. So would it be useful for someone who's dealing with trauma, for example?
Definitely. So the book is divided into three sections: your external world, your internal world, and it's really about getting you to your authentic self. So yes, it's lots of practical tools. I talk about negative thinking patterns, challenging negative beliefs, your concept of love, danger, fight or flight, attachment. So some of the stuff that we've been talking about, but in really kind of bite-sized ways, so you can actually start to put things into practice. So it's available for pre-order now on Amazon. You can find the link in my bio on my website. But also, it's officially coming out next week on the 17th of May. So I'll be uploading some stuff onto Instagram as well. But yeah, if that's something that's of interest, please do download it. And you can always go to my website as well, and there's some free additional things that you can download, like audios. So I've got a couple of visualizations that I've just put in there. There's a journal that you can use, and there's an attachment quiz as well. So that, you can use that independently or in line with the book too.
Wonderful. And if everyone wants to follow you on Instagram, where can they find you? What's the app?
Yep, so it's Dr. So Dr. Rina, Rina. Dot Bajaj, Bajaj, and the book is called The Magic in Me.
Excellent. Well, again, congratulations on the
Thank
book.
you.
I can't wait to read it. I know it's going to be full of wisdom. Thank you for your answers today. Very thorough. I think the community is going to find it very useful. So, guys, we will be getting this on the Instagram platform. So, for everyone who couldn't watch, you'll be able to watch it. And also, it'll be over on the DLC Live podcast channel if you prefer to listen to these interviews instead of watching. But yeah, thank you again for coming on and sharing your knowledge. I really appreciate it.
Thank you
And
so
yeah,
much for having
best
me.
of luck with the book. I'll definitely be sharing it with the community next week as well.
Fab, thank you so much for having me. It's really great to be here.
No problem. Take care. Have a good
Brilliant.
night.
Thanks.
Bye bye.
Bye. Bye.